This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Well, the economy was front and center during the presidential election, and we heard a lot about rebuilding the middle class and the 1% and the 99% and the 47%. But now we're pretty much back to business as usual, and we're hearing a lot about that financial fiscal cliff and the Bush-era tax cuts that are expiring and huge amounts of money being cut from the federal budget. That may mean one thing to economists and to politicians, but it may mean quite something else to all the rest of us. So joining me to talk about what this means for the average person is Marketplace's Patty Hirsch. Patty Hirsch, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So first, I know that we've, you know, heard a lot about the fiscal cliff in the media and these huge government cuts that may be coming. But I wonder, so if the government decides, okay, well, we're gonna cut in one area or another, how does that affect you if you work in a private company?
Well, this has a lot less to do with the government and a lot more to do with you and me, because what this is about is the possibility that a lot of us, a great number of us, may just stop spending, either because we've lost our jobs in layoffs or because our taxes are going up so we don't feel as wealthy. And of course, because this is such a consumer-based economy that we live in, you know, I think that some of the number that usually gets bandied around, and it's actually an incorrect number, but people talk about the economy being 70% reliant on consumer spending. It's probably not as much as that, but still, that's a significant amount. If we stop spending, if large numbers of people stop spending, then suddenly the economy is going to fall off this fiscal cliff, which is hence the exceptionally good analogy that they've come up with in Ben Bernanke's office.
Yeah, and I've actually watched that explanation that you have online. People can find it on the Marketplace website, where you talk about falling off this fiscal cliff. You draw a little picture of it on a whiteboard and compare it to Thelma and Louise going over the cliff.
Hurtling towards the cliff in their Mustang. That's exactly what we're doing right now. It's like, because it's kind of like if you're driving along the road towards the cliff and the road is sort of trending upwards, because that's the economy right now. The economy is actually doing not too badly. It's, you know, not doing great, but it's doing reasonably well. So it's like we're on this kind of upslope. But the worry is that if we actually tip over this cliff on January the 1st, if taxes do go up and you know, all these spending cuts happen so that all these people get laid off in the defense industry and other parts of the government, then people will stop spending and bada boom, the economy is going to go into a tailspin. So that's the real concern there. So it's really more about us as consumers and our willingness or lack thereof to spend that's what's driving this, rather than the government specifically.
Now, I want to get to some of those good signs in a minute, but I wonder, you know, if this all depends on compromise, and you hear Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, rather, Mitch McConnell, come out and say, you know, look, our bottom line is we're not raising taxes in a bad economy. And President Obama comes out and says, hey, look, I ran on a platform of raising taxes for certain groups of people, people making a lot of money every year, over $250,000. And that's just my bottom line. Does that worry you? Does that make you worry about the Thelma and Louise actually going over the cliff in that car?
Oh, yeah, it petrifies me. But here's the thing. A lot of people are now saying, well, you know, you can't trust these guys and the government to get their act together and actually make a decision and, you know, work together. They're a bunch of children in a playground. You know, they're not just not doing their job, which is to come together and find a consensus. So because they're failing to do that, a lot of people are saying, well, maybe we're just going to go over this cliff anyway, and that'll give people the kick in the pants that it takes to actually get the economy back on track. So I'm actually predicting that this may happen. I mean, there's going to be a lot of kind of you know, backroom dealing going on, sort of smoke-filled rooms and people horse trading and all the rest of it to try and get this thing done. But, you know, it seems to me really, really unlikely the way the rhetoric is going that they'll actually make this happen. So I think it's quite likely that we will tip over this cliff. Certainly, that's the way the economy is reacting right now, or parts of it. I mean, we saw in the Wall Street Journal today the front page headline was, you know, that the businesses are just freezing up, that they're not spending, that they're worried about consumers not spending over Christmas. So I think there's, you know, that really the effects of the fiscal cliff have already kicked in. We don't even have to go over the fiscal cliff in order for us to be, you know, gripped by this fear. And I think that's what's holding the economy kind of hostage right now, right before a really key spending season, which is really bad news for us.
Yeah, it's sort of that old bromide that what drives the markets are fear and greed. And right now we're in that period of, like you said, deep fear.
We're totally in deep, and look, we're on like I think it's 7 or 8% correction in the market right now. I mean, it's not actually a specific correction till it hits 10%, but you know, we're down a significant amount from the highs that we had earlier this year. So a lot of people are saying, well, that's fear kicking in, but of course the greed will kick in pretty soon when people see that, you know, stock prices look pretty cheap right now, and we may see the market pick back up again. But there's no doubt that those two key glands are working like crazy now, the fear on one side, the greed on the other, no doubt about it.
Now, interestingly, today we saw some very good numbers come out of housing, the best numbers in years. And I wonder, amidst all this fear, what do you make of the fact that people are saying, yeah, we're willing to buy houses, we're willing to build houses? What do you make of that?
It's crazy. I mean, one of the editors at our morning meeting today was saying that over the weekend, a friend of hers put her house on the market and she had people lining up around the block to get in. They had cupcakes with "We love your house" written on top of the cupcakes. I mean, it's like, you know, and the house sold eventually, or the house was bid 20% above the price that she put it out, the offer price.
Wow.
So it's insane. There are pockets of the housing market around this country which are just going crazy in terms of demand. I mean, parts of Seattle, you know, the west side of Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, Austin, parts of Manhattan. You know, there are really these hot spots within the market. But what's really happened in the housing market is that the banks about a year ago or so realized that foreclosures were not good for them. And actually the short sale was the way to go. Foreclosures are hurting them. They were losing more than 50% of the value of the home whenever they put these places into foreclosure. So they started to work with people in the homes and started to kick in the short sale process. And what has happened is that all of this shadow inventory that we heard about, all of these houses that were kind of overhanging the market, most of that has been now soaked up. And we're now back to a much more sort of balanced market than we were, say, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. And now home builders are starting to get really happy. The home builder index was up today. You know, they're all very excited about the prospect of building new homes. So it looks as though that part of the economy, which is a key part of the economy, because people spend so much money to fill these houses with stuff, that housing part of the economy is actually doing really well, which is great news.
So now we're just hoping nothing happens that stops people, that makes people scared to actually get in line and make that bid.
Right. Hopefully nobody's built their house on a cliff. That's what you'd be worried about.
Another interesting headline that we saw this week, and I know one of the things you do and you do in your new book is to try to break down this jargony language of Wall Street. We heard about shadow banking reaching $67 trillion last year. What is shadow banking? What role does it play in our economy?
What is shadow banking? So this book, which is Man versus Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple, you can get it anywhere where books are sold. So it's all sort of designed at sort of explaining this stuff in language you can understand rather than explaining it in more jargon, which just blows your head off. So everyone's been talking recently about these shadow banks, the shadow banking system, because you've got your banks, right? Your JP Morgans and your, you know, Chase Manhattan Bank or whatever it is, you've got these banks, but then you've got this whole kind of system that lies underneath the banking system, which is where actually most of the dealing is done. I mean, for example, before the financial crisis kicked in, most of the people doing the lending for mortgages were not banks at all. They were these kind of, they called them shadow banks. They were independent lenders. They were people who sort of channeled money from money market funds into the lending market to create mortgages. So they weren't actually part of the banking system as we understand it. And all of these investment banks that you hear about, the Goldman Sachs of this world, who, you know, these are people that are holding so much money now. They're really the archive of wealth in this country. So it's no longer the banks that hold all the power and hold all the wealth. It's these people that are sort of behind the banking system that have all the money. These money market funds, these hedge funds, people, you know, hear about these special investment vehicles, you know, the whole sort of alphabet soup of stuff. Now, you might think that's not so much of a problem. The issue is, of course, that the regulatory system that we have is really only set up to deal with the real banking system, as we understand it,
right?
Like, you know, like your Chases and your retail banks. The regulatory system isn't set up to deal with hedge funds, isn't really set up to deal with the hybrids of investment banks and these special investment vehicles. They don't know what to do with that stuff. It's kind of like a teenager, okay, who is dressed in the same clothes that he was wearing, you know, when he was 7 years old. You know, the clothes are all threadbare and getting worn out and sort of falling to pieces. The regulatory system is the same thing. It hasn't been changed really in the last 25 years, and it can't contain the financial system as it exists. And that's really dangerous for us because it means the rules aren't being written to help us out.
So interesting. So if you said to people sort of stop, today, right now, put down your money where it is, you'd find that a lot of money is not in Bank of America. A lot of money is being traded and in exchange-traded funds and money markets and right on behalf of people with their 401ks and that kind of thing.
Right. That's where all of this money's at.
Okay.
So these strange instruments, which people on Wall Street are the only ones who really have access to, we don't really understand it because we don't interface with it. We don't really interface with the retail banks. That's where all that money is. And of course, the money is the power. So that's where the power lies. So if you've got all the money and the power concentrated in this so-called shadow banking system, and the rules that we have, the regulatory system that we have, isn't even geared to dealing with these parts of the economy, then suddenly you're thinking, oh, maybe we're in a lot more danger than we thought we were. And, you know, the Dodd-Frank Act, which we hear a lot about, which is still being written, and it looks just horribly complex, even that isn't really digging into these parts of the system. It's still, once again, just dealing with these surface entities, the banks that we think of are too big to fail. The real danger is, in many ways, is that it's not that these banks are too big to fail, it's that this shadow banking system has become so enormous and so pervasive and so uncontrolled that it leaves the economy extremely vulnerable.
Hmm. I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH, and we're talking with Marketplace's Patty Hirsch. And I wonder, when you're putting a book together about simplifying language for people, do you worry at all that the amount of financial literacy we're asked for in our lives, say to manage our 401ks, is just not commensurate with the amount of financial literacy that we get from our educations in school in America?
Oh, yeah, it's a real problem because the system is hugely complex. I mean, you know, one of the big drives by Elizabeth Warren and by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was to create, forms that people could get when they were taking out a mortgage and taking out loans that were simple as opposed to like 15 pages long and written in complete gobbledygook, you know. So they asked for these. They wanted to have these really, really simple forms. But even if you read those forms, it's really hard to understand. You know, firstly, your English has got to be great. Secondly, you've got to have sort of a passing understanding of legalese because it's still written in that language. And thirdly, there's all of this terminology that's in there that unless you're prepared to get smart, unless you're prepared to sit down and do the hard work of understanding this stuff, it's really, really tough to get a grip of. So yeah, our financial literacy, just in terms of the basic things that we do, even checking and budgeting, you know, basic things that we do with banks, is really, really limited. So anything that we can do to empower people by, you know, helping them understand in simple ways how the system works has got to be a good thing.
And so does that mean when people are dealing with mutual funds and exchange traded funds and all this stuff, they in some ways are on the losing end because the people on the other end are professionals. The other people doing the big trades know, like, understand exactly what they are trading. Do you worry that we've sort of created the people who know and the people who, well, this really isn't their full-time job?
Well, I think we've always had that situation, right? The people who know and the people who don't. I mean,
right.
Anyone who's ever watched that movie, Glengarry Glen Ross, you know, knows that you've got salesmen who are going to come around and, you know, pitch property deals to you. And they're going to be talking a great game and all the rest of it. And unless you know exactly what it is that you're getting into, you're at a real, real disadvantage and you could end up getting hosed. So the message of this is, and you know, we have this on my show Marketplace Money and in the book that I've written, it's always the same message, which is keep it as simple as possible. You know, you don't have to get complex with this stuff. The more complex that you get, the more sort of involved in exchange traded funds and even trading individual stocks that you get, the more risky it becomes and the more likely you are to lose your shirt.
So I'm going to have you explain something to me that I've always not quite understood, which is how you trade futures. And I know you have an analogy for this that is very seasonally appropriate.
It's an appropriate analogy, yes. So I'm obviously not from America, so I've not been a sort of a celebrator of Thanksgiving in the past. But when I came here, I realized I needed to get a Thanksgiving turkey for Thanksgiving. So, you know, I thought, fair enough, I'll just, you know, wait till Thanksgiving Day or the day before and rock up and buy a turkey. And of course, that was a disaster because there were barely any turkeys left and I ended up with some sort of shriveled thing, carcass that was pulled out at the bottom of our freezer. So after that, I did what a lot of Americans do, which is I order my turkey in advance. So, you know, like 2 weeks beforehand, I'll go into the store when they start advertising the service and I'll get my little claim check from the store that says I can get a 20-pound turkey for $50 or whatever the price is. And that little check that I have, which has the price, the delivery date, and the value of the asset on it, or the which is the turkey itself, that is essentially what's called a future. All right, because in the future it allows me to go to a place, pay a certain amount of money, and get something in return. Now, theoretically, what could happen if the shopkeeper was going to stay good to that future? What could happen is the price of turkeys could then sort of triple because, say, turkeys all grew wings and flew away. The price of turkeys would triple, and then I have this claim check that allows me to get a turkey for the same price as it was, you know, 2 weeks ago. And I could theoretically stand in front of the store and say, "Hey, does anybody want to buy my little $20 claim check for $5?" People would be flocking to me to buy that because they'd get their turkey so cheaply. And that's what futures do. It allows you to lock in a price. All right, in advance. And sometimes you have to pay to lock in that price, which is when you buy an option. And what that does is it allows you to then take that claim check, if you will, which may be for, you know, 200 barrels of oil or, you know, 17 ounces of gold or whatever it may be. You can trade that claim check in the market. And so a lot of the time, people are just they're just trading the paper because they see the paper as having value. That's why they call it a derivative, because the little piece of paper is derived from the value of the underlying asset, which is gold or oil or turkeys or whatever it is you want to make it. And it's very easy. That's what that whole exchange was set up to do, was to basically be a bunch of people standing outside the storefront, you know, waving these claim checks for turkeys around. And that's what the exchange is.
Well, there you go. Now I understand futures a whole lot better. So when I, you know, listen to Marketplace or CNBC, I'll understand it.
And you can enjoy your Thanksgiving.
There you go. Exactly. Patty Hirsch is the senior producer of Personal Finance at Marketplace and the creator and host of the Marketplace Whiteboard. And he is also the author of Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained Plain and Simple. Patty Hirsch, thanks so much.
Kara, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And you can catch Marketplace weeknights here on 89.7 WGBH at 6 o'clock. So the question is, what is the secret to making the perfect burger or the perfect French fry? Is it maybe having a PhD in theoretical and mathematical physics? I'll be bringing you that story. I'm Kara Miller. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. Like.